It's nearly 12 o'clock and time for the KMXT Midday News. Thank you for listening to KMXT. On 100.1 FM, it's your public radio station. Broadcasting from Signal Hill, here in Kodiak, Alaska, where it's 29 degrees. Sunny skies. We've already hit our high temperature. Northwest winds to 30, gusting as high as 40 miles per hour today. So those winds haven't left us quite yet. But tonight, they're expected to die down to northwest 10. Also tonight, a 30% chance of snow, mainly after 4 a.m. We're looking at increasing cloudiness that's going to go on, they say, for the rest of next week. Coming up on the Midday News, energy company Hillcorp, has been ordered to replace its leaky undersea pipeline. A Maine company is looking at tidal power in Cook Inlet. The Supreme Court has ruled that Governor Mike Dunleavy's appointees were valid, even though the legislature failed to meet to confirm them. And Alaska is suing manufacturers of toxic PFAS. That and more after national headlines.
Live from NPR News, I'm Lakshmi Singh. A new problem with some of Boeing 737 MAX airplanes is prompting several airlines to pull dozens of the jets out of service. NPR's David Shaper reports Boeing says it's an electrical problem not related to the flight control system that had previously grounded the MAX fleet for nearly 2 years.
The FAA says Boeing notified the regulatory agency about the electrical problem late Thursday and that it could affect the operation of a backup power unit. Alaska, American, Southwest, and United are among the airlines pulling close to 70 of their 737 MAX planes temporarily out of service to address the problem. It appears to be related to a change in the production process. It affects only some recently manufactured 737 MAX jets. The problem is not related to the MCAS flight control system, which is blamed in part for causing two 737 MAX crashes in Indonesia and Ethiopia that killed 346 people. David Shaper, NPR News.
The House Ethics Committee says it'll investigate allegations that Republican Representative Matt Gaetz might have engaged in a broad range of inappropriate behavior with an underage girl. Gaetz denies the accusations. The state has called another medical expert to the stand, forensic pathologist Lindsay Thomas, to testify that George Floyd's death in Minneapolis was a direct result of the way he was being restrained by former police officer Derek Chauvin during his arrest last year.
Mr. Floyd was in a position, because of the subdual restraint and compression, where he was unable to get enough oxygen in to maintain his body functions.
Video shows Chauvin's knee on Floyd's neck for more than 9 minutes. The defense argues Chauvin was following his police training. No-knock warrants are now partially banned in Kentucky. Democratic Governor Andy Beshear today signed Brianna's Law, named for the 26-year-old ER technician who was killed during a botched police raid at her home last year. Grammy-nominated rap artist DMX has died. DMX, whose formal name was Earl Simmons, passed away today in White Plains, New York at the age of 50, days after suffering a heart attack. NPR's Andrew Limbong reports on DMX's lasting impact on music.
There was a gruff intensity to DMX's voice.
Stop, drop, shut him down, open up shop. Oh, no, that's how rough fighters roll.
DMX blew up with his debut 1998 album, It's Dark and Hell is Hot. It's a grim record about violence and sin and salvation. It went multi-platinum. X would continue that streak through the early 2000s while also acting in movies like Belly and Cradle to the Grave. He also openly struggled with an addiction to crack cocaine and did multiple stints in prison. But he kept working, kept performing, always with his signature rasp. Andrew Limbong, NPR News.
This is NPR.
NPR News is presentada a usted en parte por la Providence Kodiak Island Centro de Asesoramiento. Para una cita o más información, por favor, llama al 907-481-2400.
Energy company Hillcorp has been ordered to replace an undersea pipeline in Cook Inlet after it leaked gas last week for the fifth time in the last several years. In a corrective order dated April 6th, the Pipeline and Hazardous Materials Safety Administration told Hillcorp it must temporarily repair the 55-year-old pipeline by April 17th, permanently repair it by May 1st, and submit a plan for the pipe's replacement within 45 days. The last time the pipe leaked in 2017, Hillcorp didn't complete repairs for 3 months, citing danger from ice in the inlet. Sea ice is again a problem. Crystal Smith, an environmental program manager with the Alaska Department of Environmental Conservation, says Hillcorp is waiting for the weather to improve before sending divers down to inspect the pipeline. The pipeline administrator says in the order he thinks it's dangerous to continue to operate the pipeline due to its history of leaks and the age of the pipeline, and the fact that the pipeline's under a critical habitat for endangered species rule, including a Cook Inlet beluga, among other considerations. Smith says DEC has deployed state and federal agencies to provide input on resources that might be at risk.
Hillcorp has actually had folks out there doing wildlife observations. They have not seen any impacts to the wildlife at this time.
The leak occurred a mile from one of its platforms and 6 miles offshore from Nikiski. It was first reported Thursday evening by a helicopter pilot who spotted bubbles on the water's surface. Hillcorp reported the leak to state and federal authorities an hour later and immediately reduced pressure on the pipeline. When it could not sustain that amount of pressure, it changed course and shut the line down, the order says. Hillcorp estimates the leak initially let out between 75,000 and 150,000 cubic feet of natural gas per day. Authorities still don't know what caused the leak, but the order gives Hillcorp 4 months to find out. Before restarting operations there, Hillcorp has to submit a plan to federal regulators. The pipe was built in 1965 and had two reported leaks in 2014, a year before Hillcorp bought the pipeline. Leaks occurred again in 17 and 19, and all were repaired with clamps, the order says. Cook Inlet has long been a hotbed of oil and gas development in Alaska. But for years, renewable energy advocates have been eyeing another Cook Inlet resource, tides. The inlet has some of the largest tides in the world, but their energy potential has remained untapped. One company is trying to change that and says it could have a generator in the water in the next 3 years. Samin Pooks with Alaska's Energy Desk has this report.
Ocean Renewable Power Company of Maine is filing a permit later this spring for a pilot project in Nikiski. Marek Jakinski is one of two employees in Anchorage.
Where we're looking at the East Foreland site is mainly just because of the extreme velocity that it has there to kind of get that bigger bang for our buck right off the bat.
Anyone who's fished in the area knows the tides can really rip. That's important because ORPC's tidal tech relies on the movement of the tides to spin turbines connected to an underwater generator. The turbines work when the tide is going in and out.
And so we're always able to generate power, except during slack tide, of course.
ORPC currently has another hydrokinetic generator in Igiagig on the Alaska Peninsula. That device sits in freshwater in the Quijack River and is helping Igiagig wean off its dependence from diesel. The potential power in Cook Inlet's tides is much more vast. Studies estimate the inlet holds over a third of all tidal energy potential in the U.S. But that power has proven elusive. Multiple companies, including ORPC, have filed permits with the federal government that haven't come to fruition. One challenge has been finding a market.
Tidal power's biggest concern right now, I'd say, is solar and wind power.
Chris Rose is executive director of Renewable Energy Alaska Project, a nonprofit that advocates for renewable energy statewide. ORPC is a member.
Solar and wind power have come down so quickly in price over the last decade. It used to be that tidal power 20 years ago was competing against fossil fuels, but now really the biggest competitor is solar and wind. And so more investment has gone into those renewable technologies and less has gone into tidal.
The Cook Inlet project would be one of the first tidal power generators in the country. Jakinski estimates tidal is 10 years behind its wind and solar counterparts. Tidal energy, however, is more dependable than solar and wind, Rose says. It's predictable hundreds of years in advance.
If you were to put tidal power stations up and down Cook Inlet, they would produce power at different times of the day, which could make the resource what the utilities call a baseload resource, something that they can manipulate and count on.
Initially, the company hopes to produce a megawatt of power from the device, eventually increasing that load into the hundreds of megawatts. The rail belt as a whole has an average annual load of 600 megawatts, according to REAP. But that's all far down the road. First, ORPC has to file a preliminary permit with the federal government. Any project in Cook Inlet has to avoid damage to fish and whales that call the region home. Jakinski says salmon have been able to avoid the turbine in Igiagig. In 3 years, he says, ORPC could have a pilot device in the water. That first device wouldn't yet send power to the grid. A permanent device could take a decade.
It's more of like a marathon. It's not like a sprint, right?
As for the all-important market, ORPC thinks it has one. The company signed a joint development agreement with Homer Electric Association, the local utility, and HEA says it will purchase power generated by ORPC for its grid. Currently, HEA gets most of its power from natural gas, also produced in Cook Inlet. The oil and gas industry in Cook Inlet has slowed in recent years, with lackluster industry interest in offshore exploration and a declining supply of natural gas. Renewable advocates like Rose see tidal as a more enduring resource.
When you invest in a technology like that, you're investing in perpetuity.
He says with tides like the ones in Cook Inlet, Alaska could be at the center of tidal energy production. For Alaska's Energy Desk, I'm Sabine Pooks.
The Alaska Supreme Court ruled yesterday that many of Governor Mike Dunleavy's appointees were valid after the legislature failed to meet on whether to confirm them last year. The ruling reverses a Superior Court decision that the 94 positions had been vacated in December. The court found that a longstanding state law is unconstitutional. That law says that when the legislature fails to act on appointees, it rejects them. The ruling came 2 days after the court heard oral arguments in the case between the governor and the Alaska Legislative Council. In that hearing, Justice Dario Borgeson said the people who framed the state constitution appeared to view the joint session as a measure of how acceptable appointees are, and he questioned whether the legislature failing to act indicates their position on appointees.
How can that be squared with the framers' intent that the confirmation process really be the ultimate democratic voice on the governor's appointees?
Kodiak Republican Senator Gary Stevens chaired the council last year. He says that while his side lost, he is glad the ruling clears up an issue related to the separation of powers between the legislature and the governor.
It's always good to get the Supreme Court's interpretation of the Constitution, and so now we know.
The legislature didn't hold a joint session when it left Juneau early after the pandemic started. Stevens says he doesn't expect that will happen again. The state of Alaska is suing manufacturers of a pair of toxic PFAS compounds that have contaminated groundwater across the state. The lawsuit filed Wednesday names chemical giants 3M, DuPont, and others. It alleges the companies produced for decades toxic chemicals that do not break down, and it says they now present a significant threat to the health of Alaskans and the state's natural resources. Environmentalists called the state's lawsuit long overdue. Alaska lawmakers have been urging the governor to do more to regulate PFAS compounds, says Pamela Miller of the Alaska Community Actions on Toxins in Anchorage.
It was more than a year ago that 16 legislators, both Democrat and Republican, signed a letter to the governor asking him to file a lawsuit on behalf of Alaskans and people contaminated by PFAS.
The lawsuit focuses on two compounds, PFOS and PFOSA, that are contained in firefighting foams commonly used at airports that are designed to suppress jet fuel fires. PFOS compounds do not break down, and if ingested over time, can lead to health problems, including cancers. Environmentalists criticized the Dunleavy administration for rolling back the state's drinking water standards to only regulate two types of PFOS compounds instead of more of them. She says the lawsuit focuses on these two specific chemicals, even though the firefighting foams named in the lawsuit contain a complex mixture of PFAS compounds.
So that just by focusing on these legacy chemicals, PFOA and PFOS, I think there's really a possibility of missing a number of important PFAS chemicals that are also causing harm to communities and drinking water sources around the state.
The lawsuit's filing comes the same day as a PFAS-related bill filed by State Senator Jesse Keel. It would expand the number of PFAS compounds currently regulated by the state. It would also require PFAS polluters to pay for clean drinking water and blood tests for affected Alaskans. The Juneau Democrat applauded the Attorney General's decision to take action to help recoup some of the millions the state has already spent on PFAS-related costs.
States all across the country, red states, blue states, doesn't matter, have been getting some of the cost of cleanup covered by the manufacturers. And I think it's a very responsible and appropriate move for Alaska to do that. It's something I've been asking attorneys general to do for a couple of years now.
The Department of Law didn't immediately make anyone available for an interview. The case is being handled by contract lawyers from Anchorage firm Birch, Horton, Bittner, and Chereau. State financial records show the law department most recently paid the Anchorage law firm about $92,000 for legal work last summer. The lawsuit seeks unspecified damages to be determined at trial. The Hooper Bay Lady Warriors made history this past weekend when they won the state 2A basketball championship. They became the first Hooper Bay Lady Warriors to take the state title. The team reflected on their victory with KYUK's Anna Rose MacArthur.
Zoe Lake is a Hooper Bay senior, and she is psyched to call herself a state champ.
Really proud to say it. Yes!
Hooper Bay beat the Talkeetna-Susitna Valley Rams 36-32 on Saturday. The moment Zoe remembers most from the championship game is after the final buzzer sounded and the crowd, filled with family and friends, rushed to the winning team.
Everyone congratulating us, hugging us, and seeing their happy tears really fulfilled my heart.
One of the people she hugged was her aunt, who's her same age, a senior, and her teammate.
My name is Mary Long.
When Mary remembers that championship game, she feels two emotions.
Happiness, joy.
And marvels that her team was the first Hooper Bay girls basketball team to win state.
We did it and made history, and, you know, it's like really rare for us to win from a small town on the West Coast.
Another senior, Benice Tall, calls the win, quote, overwhelmingly awesome.
We wanted it, so we practiced and practiced.
The team returned to practice only a month before the state tournament. Before that, it'd been a year since the team had been on the court. The pandemic canceled last year's state games. Benice had only touched a basketball a few times in the past year, throwing shots in an outdoor hoop during the summer. When the Hooper Bay School resumed in-person classes in early March, basketball practice also resumed. Benice, who plays forward, said she had to relearn some elements of the game.
Post moves and running, communicating with the team.
Brandy Hale is the lead coach for the Lady Warriors. She had to find a balance between conditioning the girls to play competitively and preventing injury.
We started off kind of slow, just to get their bodies moving, and then slowly started getting harder and harder and harder.
Their first game of the season was against Point Hope, just a week after starting practice.
And we got slaughtered. They just outran us.
But the team kept practicing. Coach Brandy grew up in Hooper Bay. She attended Mount Edgecombe High School, where she played on the state basketball championship team in 2010. She knew what it took to win state and believed that her Lady Warriors could do it this year.
Because I knew their potential and I know that they're talented. So just having them believe in themselves.
The team is mostly seniors with no freshmen. Brandy has coached for 3 years. She built this team. That makes the state victory particularly sweet.
They have grown a lot, both on the court and off the court. They became better leaders. They became better communicators. Their attitude has improved. So they just matured a lot, and I'm extremely proud of that.
The three seniors we heard in this story were each distinguished as all-star players during the state tournament. Coach Brandy is proud of them. Zoe Lake was named player of the game after Thursday's match.
She's She's a big part of our offense. She's a big part of our defense. And she's our main post player. And she's a lefty. Guarding a lefty, especially down in the post, is hard. And she can shoot.
Mary Long was named player of the game after Friday's semifinal.
She wants to win, and she holds her teammates accountable for that. She's fast. She could drive it in. She gets a lot of rebounds and goes coast to coast. She's our best three-point shooter. And she gets a lot of steals, too.
And for the championship match on Saturday, Benice Tall was named player of the game.
She's the most calm. She's always positive. She's always encouraging. And she gets a lot of rebounds, too, as well. And in that championship game, she got most of the assists to Zoe.
Coach Brandy says on the plane back to Hooper Bay, she and the team wished they could relive the entire tournament all over again. In Bethel, I'm Anna Rose MacArthur.
Are you a squared away person who takes care of business?
Affirmative.
Is your car tuned up, your lawn mowed, your tires rotated, laundry folded, dog trained, and budget balanced?
That's a Roger.
Then you are probably the kind of person who donates early to his local public radio station. The job is done and taken care of. Receipts filed, book closed. And of course, you get double the entries to win the big drawing. Every $25 you donate before April 12th gets you two entries for your chance to be flown to any cabin in the Kodiak National Wildlife Refuge for a four-day stay, courtesy of the refuge and Seahawk Air.
I'm at the KMXT website, clicking on the button now.
You can also give us a call at 486-3181.
This is Alaska Fish Radio. I'm Lainey Welch. Alaskans are wanted for high-paying maritime jobs. More after this.
The Alaska Seafood Marketing Institute provides digital and print marketing materials to the Alaska seafood industry. Find thousands of stunning photos, high-quality video footage, and sales tools at alaskaseafood.org.
Alaska fishermen displaced by the COVID pandemic are being recruited for merchant marine jobs aboard U.S. ships from tankers to towboats, cargo barges, cruise and research ships, and more. The Seafarers International Union is calling for 300 apprentice workers.
We're looking for able-bodied seamen, but in our world, they're called able seafarer deck because you have to have that qualification in order to sail internationally.
Bart Rogers is assistant vice president at the Harry Lundberg School of Seamanship in Maryland that's been training mariners for the Seafarers Union for over 50 years. People with culinary experience also are wanted to be trained as chief cooks, as well as apprentices and stewards. The training programs vary from several months to a year.
There's no tuition for attending the school. There is incidental costs, but it would be very appealing to people who live in Alaska because, number one, they could sail in a safe environment and earn a very good wage, benefit, advanced training is guaranteed, and then they can go back home and spend the money they make.
Mariners also can schedule trips to fit in a fishing season. Ketchikan-based Sea Link has recruited and referred up to 600 Alaskans to maritime trades. Director Ralph Mursky.
The reason for that is real simple. They make a lot of money in a short period of time, and they can still do what they want to do at home.
Recruitment is now open nationally, and there also are options for veterans and native hires. Overall, Bart Rogers says Alaskans are at the top of their list.
The reason for that is pretty simple. The people from Alaska come with a work ethic already. They've been working since they could stand up, and that's why they're so good.
Rogers adds that women make some of the best maritime workers.
Don't get me wrong, but the women are smarter and work harder than the men all day long.
Learn more at mymaritimecareer.org and find links at alaskafishradio.com. Fish Radio is also brought to you by OBI Seafoods. In Kodiak, I'm Lainey Welch.
This is the Island Messenger, a look at personal messages, the weather, and community announcements.
Good afternoon. Welcome to your Island Messenger for Friday. It is the ninth day of April, the year 2021. The sun rose at 7:15 this morning. It won't set again until 9:10, giving us 13 hours and 55 minutes of glorious daylight. That is a gain of 4 minutes and 57 seconds compared to yesterday. Our record low for this date was 14, set in 68 and 86. and our record high was 57, set in 1941. We're not going to reach that, but we are up to 30 degrees now. Sunny skies, northwest wind to 30, could gust as high as 40 this afternoon, but is expected to finally come on down tonight. 30% chance of snow tonight, mainly after 4 a.m. Increasing clouds overnight with a low around 20, northwest winds to 10. And then starting on Saturday, rain and snow likely before 1 p.m., then the chance of rain between 1 and 4 p.m., mostly cloudy skies tomorrow with a high near 36. Southeast wind to 10. We'll turn to the north tomorrow afternoon. Looking at our local tides here on the east side, we have a high tide coming up at 1:21 p.m. That will be a 7.9-foot tide, followed by a low tide at 7:45 p.m. of 0.07 feet. Let's call that a zero-foot tide. Your next high tide will be at 2:04 a.m. and be 8 feet, and our low tide for tomorrow morning on the east side will be at 8:05 a.m. and be 0.6 feet. Over on the west side, and these are Euganic Pass tides, you have a high tide coming up at 2:02 p.m. of 14 feet, followed by a low tide at 8:19 p.m. of minus 0.1 foot. Your high tide for the middle of the night will be at 2:30 a.m. and be 14.9 feet. And your low tide for tomorrow morning on the west side will occur at 8:37 a.m. and be 0.1 foot. Mariners, here's your synopsis for the North Gulf Coast, including Kodiak Island waters and Cook Inlet. Strong northwest gap winds will remain over the western Gulf through this afternoon. A weak front will reach the southwest Gulf Saturday morning and move to the north Gulf on Sunday morning. The next front will approach the southwest Gulf on Sunday morning. Our resulting weather, still pretty crummy. Marmot Island to Sitkanak, Kodiak's east side offshore, gale warning today and heavy freezing spray warning today as well. Northwest 40 right now, should diminish to 30 knots this afternoon. Seas to 20 feet, should subside to 12 feet this afternoon. Heavy freezing spray. For tonight, west 15 becoming south 20, north of Dangerous Cape, northwest 30 becoming variable 10 after midnight. Seas to 8 feet. Freezing spray in the morning tomorrow. For Saturday, south wind to 20, seas to 6 feet. Over on our west side in the Shelikof Strait, gale warning today and a heavy freezing spray warning today. Northwest 35 right now, should diminish to 20 knots this afternoon. Seas to 8 feet, subsiding to 4 feet this afternoon, and heavy freezing spray. For tonight, variable 10 becoming east 20 after midnight. Seas to 3 feet with freezing spray after midnight tonight in the Shelikof. For tomorrow, northeast 25, seas to 6 feet.
Listen for the Island Messenger here on Public Radio KMXT 2 times a day, Monday through Friday at 9 a.m. and during the midday report at 12:20. If you have a community announcement or personal message, including lost and found items or pets, you can call KMXT at 486-3181, fax us at 486-2733, or email psa@kmxt.org.
KMXT is supported in part by Orion's Mountain Sports, featuring equipment, clothing, and footwear for your outdoor lifestyle. Orion's Mountain Sports, located at 1247 Mill Bay Road. Hello, Kodiak, and welcome to the April 9th edition of Island Byways. I'm Pam Foreman. Woo-wee, that was some wind yesterday. One has to wonder whether spring will finally ever really spring this year. I have to remind myself that this is really not all that unusual for us this time of year. Mother Nature likes to toy with us a bit in April. A little sun, a little warm, a little snow, and coming up soon, a little rain. It's all part of the cycle we enjoy living on this island paradise. A positive note about the wind, you truly never know what the wind might bring in. If you're a birder, windy days or the day or two right after a big wind can bring some great birding opportunities. There are a lot of spring migrants moving around now, and sometimes winds like yesterday's will blow them off course, bringing them to our waters and shores for a few days while they regroup. So while you're out birding or hiking, keep an eye out for the unusual. Swans have been frequenting Mission and Potato Patch Lakes here in town and Cowson Pond out in the Cowson Bay area. There are northern pintails, buffleheads, gadwalls, northern shovelers, and all manner of ducks being seen here and there around the road system. Keep your binoculars with you when you're out and about. You'll be glad you did. Another of our migrating species was spotted recently off Passagshack Point, the gray whales. The first set I've heard of this year, although there may have been some earlier ones too. They're on their way to the rich feeding grounds in the Chukchi and Bering Seas. Coming through first on their way north are the males, juveniles, and newly pregnant females. Moms and calves will come along later on their trek north. We will get to enjoy whale watching from shore from now until they make their way back to California in late summer and fall. And that's it for Island Byways this week. Have fun and stay safe out there. Thanks for listening.